Imagine you could experience the world the way someone else does. Not just see through their eyes, but feel what they feel, love what they love, hate who they hate. As it is, your perception of reality is filtered through years of experiences, heartbreak, and trauma. It builds up barriers in your head between your reality and my reality. I'm Bob Carlson, and coming up on the Unfictional Podcast, stories that melt those barriers, stories of perception. The episodes this season are about seeing things from new perspectives, opening up to different viewpoints, finding surprises in the past, and seeing yourself in a new way. But this first story is about a brain experiment that leads to a sudden flash of understanding. This is the story of John Elder Robison, who lived the first part of his life feeling very little connection to other people, but with a profound connection to sound, machines, and electronics. He designed stunt guitars for Kiss concerts in the 1970s. He built circuitry for early video games. But he did it all alone. He never felt like he could read faces or understand the unspoken communication that seemed to be going on automatically for everyone else.
I didn't know how to connect with other people. I looked at the world around me and I tried to figure out how to engage it, but I never could get that right.
But then he signed up for an experimental brain study, and it allowed him to see glimpses of what he'd been missing.
And you go into a laboratory and they throw a switch in your head and suddenly you walk out of the lab and you realize, holy shit, it wasn't bullshit, it's real.
From KCRW, it's Unfictional and My Foolish Illusion.
3 and 4 years old, sitting in a sandbox, I saw other kids playing together and I wanted the kids to play with me. But I didn't know how to make that happen. And when I tried to make it happen, I said and did the wrong things, and I ended up alone. My parents were wrapped up in their own world, and I didn't have many friends. They gave me an electronics kit for Christmas when I was 13, and I tried to put it together, and I couldn't make it work. My mother said, oh, my friend Mrs. Edwards, her husband is an electrical engineering professor. And he handed me over to the grad students. They became my heroes and they answered all my questions and we made my electronic kit work. And I went on from there to learn about sound and waves and electronic circuits that change sounds. My father was drunk a lot of nights, sometimes violent when he was drunk. He might attack me or he might attack my mother. In retrospect, it's sad and it's unfortunate, but it was my reality. So I didn't think of it as this is awful. It was all I knew. It drove me to leave home and go camp in the woods. And I didn't like living in the woods and foraging, you know, for scraps to eat, and it was clear that I had to find a way to make money, get food to support myself, have a place to sleep at night, and no one else was going to do that for me.
But it wasn't people that came to his rescue. It was machines. He understood them perfectly.
I was very lucky because I had by then developed a skill fixing and working with electronics. It was used by bands, and I got hired by a local band who gave me a place to live in a communal house where all the musicians lived, and that was the beginning of my independent life. I worked with bigger and bigger bands, working for a company called Britannia Row, who was Pink Floyd's sound company at that time, and I became their engineer. One day, the folks from Kiss came into the studio. I got talking to one of their guitar players, Ace Frehley, who wanted to make a Gibson Les Paul guitar blow fire. And I said, well, We could route out the back of the guitar and we could put a box in there. And he like listens to me for a few minutes and he turns to his roadie and he says, "Tex, have Gibson get this guy a guitar."
You want it, the best, and you got it. The hottest band in the land, Kiss!
A Kiss concert of the late 1970s was loud and theatrical. There was fire breathing, explosions, unnaturally long tongues, and those iconic painted faces. And one of the standout moments of the show would come when guitarist Ace Frehley would step forward with his long black hair flowing behind him and his face painted white with a big silver star painted around each eye and what he held in his hands.
Well, it looked on stage like a stock Gibson Les Paul guitar.
But this was not a stock guitar. This one had the power to spin in the air and set Ace Frehley on fire.
We routed out the back of the guitar so you could see clean through the pickup hole. The inside of the hole, we installed first one, then two, then three smoke bombs, and one and then two high-powered projection lamps, brighter than car headlights. So when you looked at the front of the guitar, it looked completely stock, but when you turned one of the knobs, it looked like this blinding light, like the sun was shining out of Ace's guitar. And meanwhile, it was pouring so much smoke that Ace was like wrapped up in a cloud of smoke. And it looked like, you know, we had set the place on fire. And then we put a hook on the end of that guitar's neck and we dropped a cable with a powerful magnet. And Ace would swing that guitar over his head and the magnet would grab it. And when he felt the magnet grab it, he would throw it out towards the audience, and the cable would reel it in, and the guitar would start rising into the air, and it was spinning like a lighthouse, and all the while it was, you know, shining like a lighthouse. And he picked up another identical guitar and started playing that. That guitar had a three-barrel rocket launcher at the end of the neck, and it shot rockets. And the first two rockets exploded in the air over the audience's head, and they rained down confetti, and it was a boom, you know, that overpowered the sound system. And the third rocket blew up a charge up by that guitar, which was now hoisted up to the ceiling, and everything went quiet. Boy, if you saw that, you never forgot it. We went out and kicked ass with those shows, and people still talk about them today.
Coming up, John Elder Robison makes a major discovery about himself and writes a book, and then the brain therapy treatments that temporarily wakes up an ability to read signals from other people, which he'd been blind to before. From KCRW, it's Unfictional.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional, and the story of John Elder Robison, who lived the first part of his life feeling very little connection to other people, but with a profound connection to sound, machines, and electronics.
I may not have been able to read your facial expressions. I couldn't tell if you thought I was sweet or you thought I was foolish. But I could look at and feel a sound system and I could make it sing in ways that most people could not do. While I lacked vision and sensitivity in one area, I had a great abundance of it in other areas. You have to be able to listen to something. Like you have to hear feedback and say, that's 4.5, I gotta bring down, or I gotta bring up 120 or 250. You can't just experiment with all 27 bands on the equalizer, you've gotta know. I learned to translate patterns I could see into things I would hear, and I could hear them in my mind. I could look at something on a screen sound wave, for example, with an oscilloscope, a piece of test equipment, and I could imagine in my mind how it would sound if it was rendered as audio. It made me feel like I was a part of it. I felt like I was a part of the waves. Sometimes when we used to use vacuum tube amps in the 1970s, I would stand behind the stage and I would just look into the amplifiers and I would see the blue glows inside the power tubes, and I could see the music in the blue glow of the tubes, and I could tell if it was clean or if it was distorted. I could tell what they were playing just by watching the glow of the tubes. And that ability gave me a very powerful advantage in creating circuitry.
And he used that skill designing electronics for some of the earliest generations of portable games.
So I worked with Milton Bradley in designing digital synthesized sound effects.
It was the Milton Bradley Microvision, one of the first handheld game consoles.
The noises we created in the 70s, those are kind of standards today.
And he worked for the government, designing power systems for underground nuclear test monitoring.
Using the same ability to visualize sound waves, but using them in reverse to suppress those waves. And then one day I decided I'd had enough of working for other people because I didn't really understand those companies and I hated it. It wasn't music. It wasn't something I liked.
So he started his own business.
I'm just going to quit this and I'm going to fix cars.
Fancy cars.
Bentley and Rolls-Royce and Land Rover and Mercedes and Jaguar, and that business took off. I had no idea about autism or anything like that. I knew that I was different from other people. People had told me all my life that I was a weirdo, a freak, an eccentric. I mean, they called me lots uglier names than that. But, you know, I had felt the pain of loneliness and not being able to tell if other people were thinking kindly or badly about me or what. You know, I could never read other people. And it was only when a therapist, actually, who had gotten to know me through work, he said, "You've told me so many times how you feel like you're alone and you're an outsider and you're looking at the world and you don't understand it. There is a condition that accounts for it and you could be the poster boy for it. It's a thing called Asperger syndrome and it's part of the autism spectrum. Look at these traits, not being able to look people in the eye or not understanding body language and standing so close I made someone feel threatened or turning away and make them angry because I ignored them. And it was like every one of them was me. And I started to change my behavior with the knowledge of autism informing me. And that was so transformational, I wanted to share that news with other people because I thought there must be other young people growing up and having, you know, crummy life experiences, just like I did. And I thought, well, maybe I can help them avoid that. Maybe the answer is write a book.
The book was called Look Me in the Eye, published in 2007. He'd never written anything like this before, but the book became a New York Times bestseller. But it wasn't the first bestseller that came out of the family. His brother was Augustine Burroughs, who wrote the 2002 book called Running with Scissors. In fact, you can find a video online where he helps to promote his brother's book.
Hey, this is Augustine Burroughs, and my brother, John Elder Robison, has written a memoir. It's called Look Me in the Eye, and it's about growing up with Asperger's syndrome. Asperger's syndrome is...
Lots of people asked me to speak after the book was announced. And I had been invited to speak at a local college, Elms College. And before the talk, a young woman came up to me and she said she worked for a hospital in Boston, Beth Israel, and they were looking for autistic adults to take part in this study. And it was about a way they might be able to increase the ability to read emotional cues. Well, that's the thing that I haven't been able to do all my life. And I thought, I want to try that.
It was an experimental brain therapy called transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, spearheaded by the neuroscientist Alvaro Pascual Leone.
Their idea was that they could position an electromagnet outside your head, put pulses of energy into the magnet, and through the process of electromagnetic induction, they could induce tiny signals in the microscopic wires between brain cells under the magnet. And I understood how that worked because electromagnetic induction, that's the principle that we use to make sound out of loudspeakers. It's what's used in transformers to couple power from the utility pole into your home. It's everywhere. And I guess because I was comfortable with the technology, I wasn't scared. Now, other people listened to me talk about it, and they thought, shit, you're crazy, letting somebody fire energy into your head. You're nuts.
The plan was for him to have 6 sessions spread out over a few weeks.
The researchers said the therapy seems to be something that builds over time. So they said, if we stimulate a part of your brain for 30 minutes, it's only going to affect you for 15 or 20 minutes, and then it'll wear off. They first had to establish a baseline. They sat me in front of a computer monitor and they flashed faces in front of me on the screen. And I had to push buttons that said happy or sad or jealous or angry. And I watched these faces go by and, you know, and my hand just kind of sat there. I had absolutely no clue what I was seeing. They had previously made sophisticated 3-dimensional maps of the inside of my brain. And the computer somehow calculated from the outside of my face where they needed to put their machine. They pushed a button on the floor and it started going pop, pop, pop once a second. And it was delivering this energy in pulses into my head. Every time it did it, I would feel like a twitch on the top of my head. It didn't feel good. Didn't feel bad either. It kind of put my mind in neutral. And all of a sudden, the thoughts just were out of my head. And I thought, I'll count pulses. And I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then I just forgot and lost track. There's a cooling fan on the stimulation machine, and it's running, and the fan's really noisy. All of a sudden, the fan goes off, and the pulses stop, and the scientist says, okay, it's over, and it was like 30 minutes had passed, just like that. And they sat me back in the chair, and they flashed more faces in front of me, and I had exactly the same response. I didn't have a clue what those expressions were. And I thought to myself, well, what kind of crazy fool was I to think that I could sit here in a chair and these mad scientists would zap me and all of a sudden I could read expressions in other people. I'm not any different than when I came in. And they kept me there a couple hours to watch me, to make sure that nothing happened, and they sent me home. I had a 2-hour drive to get home. I turned on old recordings. And it was like it was alive. You know, it was like I was back in 1980 and I was standing backstage and I was at the show and I wasn't even in the car anymore. It was like living in a hallucination as I drove the car. I heard everything differently. All of a sudden, that night, I heard for the first time the meaning of the words of the singers.
Oh, how I long to take your hand and say, don't cry.
I realized these were songs of love and sadness and joy and hope, and they were sung about actual people. They were sung by one person to another.
The honesty's too much.
And I had never really understood that. I had never felt the feelings of the singers of the songs.
I want to hold you till I die, till we both break down and cry.
A And that was a really remarkable thing to feel all of a sudden. Nothing was the same.
His reaction was unusual and extreme compared to others who took part in the study.
I had a wife and a son, just about 18 years old. He was also autistic. He still is autistic. He actually signed up to participate in the TMS studies with me.
And he didn't have the same kind of reactions, but his eyesight and hearing became more vibrant temporarily.
My wife at that time, Martha, was very dubious about the studies. She said, "You're fine like you are. Everyone likes you like you are. Why do you want to change yourself?" And she was very dubious and even fearful of that.
As it turns out, his wife probably had a reason to worry. This was an experimental study, and by definition, unexpected things happen. And even though the effects of each TMS session was temporary, they left behind a cognitive dissonance for John Elder Robison that had a long and profound effect on him.
It's like you were colorblind all these years, and you saw the world in black and white, and everyone around you talked about color, and you came to think of this as, what's this bullshit they're telling me? There's no color. I know what my eyes tell me. And you go into a laboratory and they throw a switch in your head and suddenly you walk out of the lab and you realize, holy shit, it wasn't bullshit. It's real. I see the blue sky and the yellow car and the green grass and the red shirt. And it's real. And even then, imagine the ability to see color fades away and tomorrow morning you're back to black and white. You will live the rest of your life informed by the knowledge that color is real. The biggest negative that came out of the research was the shattering of my foolish illusion. Even though I didn't know how to read body language, I believed that other people could. And I thought all those messages I couldn't read must be beautiful and sweet. Because people said bad things to me all my life. They said, "You're a jerk, you're obnoxious, you're rude, you're inconsiderate." But I never received good messages. I thought, those must be the messages I'm blind to. And when that brain stimulation temporarily turned on the ability for me to look in people's eyes and see feelings and emotions, those feelings and emotions were not the beauty and sweetness I imagined. They were fear and jealousy and anxiety. And to have somebody, you know, a customer at work who looks at you with contempt. You want people coming in that are contemptuous of you? Or would you rather not know? You realize that somebody has been mocking you and making fun of you for years. It's a really sad thing because you think, maybe I'd be better off not knowing. Do you really want to not know that someone you think is your friend is telling jokes about you and laughing at you when they're somewhere else? Or would you rather know and think, well, they're really not your friend? There's no good answer to that kind of question. I was overwhelmed by depression that I had been oblivious to before, and it just dragged me down, and it felt like it was drowning me. A sad truth that has emerged from research. We autistic people are 9 or 10 times more likely to die by suicide than the general population. And I hope it doesn't happen to me, but it almost did.
In 2016, John Elder Robison wrote about the TMS study in a book called Switched On, a memoir of brain change and emotional awakening. He talks about the changes, both good and bad, that came out of the experience.
Brother John Elder Robison has written a memoir. It's called
Before Look Me in the Eye came out. My brother just walked down to the meadow where I was clearing a field with my farm tractor, and he said, "Hey, John Elder, I want to make a video and we'll post it online with me asking you about your book." And so he records this couple minute video asking me questions.
"What are you doing out here?
Raking the yard."
"Oh, okay. So what's your book called?"
And it's a pretty popular video. It's on YouTube, and it's probably been viewed a lot of times.
"And what's it about?"
It's about growing up and going out on my own and this Asperger's thing.
So what's the difference between Asperger's and...
The person in that tractor video is really robotic and flat and mechanical?
Well, Aspergians like me are sort of smart misfits mostly.
You like machines more than you like people, don't you?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I like machines. I like tractors. And
I mean, if this tractor...
And if you contrast the person you see in that video and the person talking today, those are two very different people. If you read my stories and books and the things that I created in music and, you know, toys and games and stuff, those were solitary pursuits. I designed electronic circuits basically by myself. I wrote books by myself. I took photographs by myself. Now, I serve on the federal government committee that produces a strategic plan for autism for our country. And I serve on committees for the World Health Organization and for the National Institutes of Health. People sometimes say I'm a leader in bringing people together. And I speak to thousands of students at colleges and universities around the country that invite me every year. And those are all group activities. And I credit TMS with having a significant impact in changing or shaping my ability to engage groups like that. I actually think that's the most important stuff I've done in my life. So I think that's the biggest way that I am different. This was not a treatment for autism that I took part in. This was an experiment that happened to be powerfully impacting on me. It was not a planned treatment being tested. But I do think that my experience shows that this brain stimulation is a powerful tool that, with proper development and research and proving out, can be a powerful, powerful thing for neuroscience to help people in the future. The ability may have been temporary, the effect temporary, but the impact on me is forever.
John Elder Robison is the author of 4 books, including the 2 mentioned in the story, plus a guide for other autistic people called Be Different, and Raising Cubby, a father and son's adventures with Asperger's, trains, tractors, and high explosives. I'm Bob Carlson, the producer of Unfictional. The managing producer of the program is Carla Green. The editor is Nick White. The theme music is by Alex Weston. Music help from Joe Augustine and Narrative Music. The Whistler is Jonathan Mee. And please subscribe to Unfictional wherever you get your podcasts. On the next episode of Unfictional, a story from a prisoner at Begnenstraat prison in Belgium.
That makes you say, this guy, it's really innocent.
In a wing for prisoners deemed too dangerous to return to society.
And I speak it in English because I know we're gonna reach the hearts of the Americans.
It's a story called Purple Rain. I'm Bob Carlson. Join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW.